Happy Thursday, Nod Pod. Thank you guys so much for joining us for another episode of Chasing Heroin, the podcast where we talk about how we get and stay sober and how we elevate the quality of our lives and long-term recovery as well. We share tips, we share hope, we share funny-ass stories, we share the good, the bad, the ugly. My name is Janine. I'm your host. After 15 years of active addiction that left me homeless and in and out of jail, in January 2015, I finally broke the cycle and now have been clean and sober since then. And it's my life's passion to not just share with people how I was able to stop and share with people how other people were able to stop, but why I believe that our life as dope fiends, as addicts, actually makes us more successful in life. And that our addiction is an asset and not a liability. And that is what today's episode is about. Today we are going to be talking about the dope fiend hustle, which then becomes the newcomer grind. You guys know what I'm talking about, the dope fiend hustle, where you're living moment to moment, just trying to get well, trying to come up with your next hustle, trying to get money, trying to eke out a living, trying to get by, dodging and lying and ducking to everybody, and in general, just not living our best life. And then the newcomer grind in the beginning when nobody trusts us and we can't get a bank account. And again, we're just like eking out survival. Those two phases of my life, I thought would be the end of me. And it turns out not only were they not the end of me, they made me much more successful later in life. And I believe that they will make you all much more successful later in life. So today I'm sharing with you guys my lead from a 12-step meeting in April of 2023. This was a Cocaine Anonymous meeting, which was cool for me because the very first meeting that I ever went to actually was a Cocaine Anonymous meeting back in 2008. I always say cocaine was my first love in the drug world. The color of the world changed when I first did cocaine, and that was truly the first substance that drew me in, and that was where my journey started. And so to be able to share at a CA meeting for the first time, to be able to lead one, was very full circle for me. Also, I wanted to let you guys know I'm going to take a super duper short break. Again, a really short one, like the one I took when my husband first came back. 6 weeks, probably. I'm booking a bunch of really amazing guests, and all of that is a bit of a process. And then also, I really fell behind a lot while Skylar was using. I know some of you guys know my husband relapsed for about a year and a half, and everything got super crazy. And now that he's back and he's got his marbles together, we need to like fix stuff in the house and, you know, steam clean the carpet and, you know, just stuff like that. And I've fallen behind a bit. So very short break, 4 to 6 weeks. Don't leave me. Go follow me on YouTube. I will actually also during that time be finally posting some of the video interviews that we have on YouTube. I did the audio a long time ago, but haven't yet posted the video. So if you're not following over on YouTube, please do so. And of course, stay up with me on TikTok and Instagram. Well, I will be staying active and checking in. Oh, I've also started posting some fitness stuff on YouTube as well. Stuff that you guys can just do at home. So if you're into that, let me know. Okay, guys, so I will see you in just a few weeks. And as always, please let me know what you think of the episode. It was a big meeting, but I had like this vision as I was driving here of like eating it on those stairs, because I spoke here once before a while ago for an AA meeting, and I was wearing heels because I dressed up, and I like almost like ate shit on those stairs. So that's good. I didn't do that at least. Hi, my name's Janine. I'm an addict. And I'm super stoked to be at a Cocaine Anonymous meeting because CA was actually the very first meeting that I ever went to in LA in 2008. Cocaine was my original, I know you guys talk about everything here, but cocaine truly was like I'll see it, I'll be in AA meetings sometimes and people talk about the first time they drank and it was like, they're like, I drank and I knew and it changed my life. And I didn't feel that way with alcohol, but I did feel that way with cocaine for sure the first time I did it. And I remember going to that CA meeting, it was in Culver City in LA, if anybody knows that area. And I was thinking about this on the way over here, I'd forgotten this. So right next to that meeting, there was a place called Johnny's Pastrami. And I would meet, my boyfriend was making me go to the meeting, of course. I didn't want to be going to the meeting, but he was making me go to the meeting because he was mad at me for doing too much coke. And I remember meeting him at Johnny's Pastrami afterwards and ordering a hot dog and a Heineken. And he was like, wait, what? And I was like, oh yeah, no. So actually, this is pretty cool. At CA, they actually tell you, they encourage you to keep drinking so that it's easier for you to quit doing coke so it's not overwhelming. And I remember he was like, well, that makes sense. And I remember thinking, that does make sense. I should try that. I should try to focus on my drinking instead, and maybe that will help me. Spoiler alert, that did not help, right, obviously. My sobriety date is January 15th, 2015. So 8 years later, or however much longer. So I just celebrated 8 years of sobriety. Which is insane. And I know everybody says that, right? And I spent so much time like sitting in rooms, watching people like me say it was impossible for them to stop using. And it just didn't feel, I would think like it might have been, it couldn't have been as hard for you as it is for me, because there you are, here I am, and I just can't stop, you know? I could not stop by the end. I could not stop shooting heroin, and I could not stop smoking meth. I could not stop for years and years and years, and I was in this cycle of being homeless or in jail or in programs around here in North County, or sober living, so that I got kicked out of all of them in all the areas, right? But at that first CA meeting, and this is what stood out to me, at that first CA meeting, I heard something basically along the lines of like, blah, 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 blah. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. Blah, 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 blah. And I heard that and I thought, if that's your pitch to me, that I'm not going to regret what I've done, then you and me are not the same. And this is not the place for me. Because there is no way I'm not going to regret what I've done. There is no way I'm not going to wish to shut the door on this. I have lost too much. And I didn't come here so that I could feel better about what I lost. I came here because I want my shit back. And if your pitch to me is that I'm going to be okay with what I've done, this is not the place for me. And I left. And the reason I felt that way, and I found that this is true with most addicts, and I know I'm biased, but I think that we as a people are typically like geniuses, like legit, really. Like addicts are the most brilliant, funny people I've ever met in my entire life. Like the hardest I've ever laughed in my life. Like that dude, Rabbit, that guy would make me laugh. I don't know where he went. But when I was in rehab, the hardest I have ever laughed, of course, is outside smoking now, of course. I would have been out there too. In rehab, the hardest I ever laughed in my life was in rehab. I went to a place in Vista that I loved. I like legit loved my rehab. I kept going back. And I would just, I loved being there, you know? We're so funny and we're so smart. And when we can leverage that like dope fiend grind and that hustle for good and not evil, we can change our life, you know, which is what happened. And I'm really passionate about, you know, helping other people understand that. So the reason I felt like I had lost too much is that, so growing up, I'm from Georgia, and I went to this like really academically advanced school. I took 5 AP classes my senior year of high school, and I got a 1400 on my SATs, and I was super duper smart, and I was a really good kid. I drank a little, I smoked cigarettes. That was like as far as I went. I didn't like smoking weed. Uh-oh. Oops. Oh, that little guy's so sweet, too. Anyways, my husband texted me right before I started, and he said, do it for Tanky, which is our pug, and that just reminded me of my pug, Tank. Anyways, so I did really well in high school, right? And I wanted to go to this great college, and I got an early admission to this great college in Washington, D.C., and I was a good kid. And my senior year of high school, my parents split up. And am I allowed to cuss? And, you know, some of them you're not, like Faith at the other one, we can't cuss, and I always fuck it up. And I lost my fucking mind. That's the best way to put it, when my dad left. I lost my fucking mind. And I'd already gotten into school, so I went to D.C., I went to my fancy college, and I was so sad. I couldn't make it work when I was up there. And so after one semester of very poor academic performance, I left, and I went to the University of Georgia, go Dogs. And I couldn't make it work there either, because it wasn't the location, it was me. And I just couldn't go to school. And the reality is, it wasn't my parents' divorce either. What it was that college is harder than high school. And a hallmark of addiction that I recognize in myself now is that the rules didn't really apply to me, right? And delusions of grandeur, and things should be easier. And in high school, it was easier. And in college, like, I had to get up early, I had to take a bus to a parking garage, and then or I had to drive to a parking garage, take another bus somewhere else, I had to buy books and haul them around, and I didn't want to do any of that stuff, you know? I didn't want to do any of that. So I started bartending, and that was when I did coke for the first time. And that experience that I was talking about, I remember, because I was a horrible bartender. I hated bartending. I hated it. I was the only girl at this bar, this like super redneck bar. And I was kind of redneck, and I'd wear a cowboy hat and like sit back. You could smoke inside and smoke cigarettes behind the bar, and people would walk up and ask for drinks, and I would just sit there like the rudest bartender you've ever seen. And then I did a line of Coke once, and I remember thinking, well, if this is what life is for other people, like I can do this. If it's like this, I can do this, you know? Like this feels great, I'm not sad anymore. And I walked out and I was like this great bartender. And so I was like, you know, doing Coke here and there, it was definitely an issue, but it wasn't super bad, right? Because I'm such an example of like the progression of this thing, right? It wasn't that bad. But I didn't want to keep going to college, and so I decided, and this is another just like such an addict tendency that I know looking back, I decided that it would be easier to move to LA and become an Oscar award-winning, Emmy award-winning actress instead of finishing college, instead of going to class. It would be easier to go win an Oscar. I believe that. And so I packed up my shit and my Saturn, and I drove across the country at 22 years old to be an actress because I didn't want to get up at 8 a.m. for class. So I drove to LA, and my Coke habit followed me, right? And it continued while I was there. And what happened was that over the course of the 8 years that I lived there, that progressively got worse, right? There was actually, again, I remember this on the way here because I've never done like where I've talked specifically about Coke. I remember my Coke use was really out of control and I had smoked meth a couple of times. And so, and I was like, oh, I like this better actually. And so I remember I hung up a calendar on my wall and I marked 3 nights and I was like, I'm gonna do meth on those nights instead of doing Coke. And that's gonna help me quit doing Coke. Like totally like subbed out meth for Coke. And it kind of worked, but I was smoking weed every single day the whole time. So it's like, but I would always look back and be like, nope, I was clean once for like 3 years. I was only smoking meth, no Coke. So it progressed over time, and what happened is my car blew up after 8 years because I was buying Coke all the time and I wasn't ever changing the oil in my car. So I had to leave LA with all my stuff in a black trash bag, which became like a hallmark of my life. Like leaving, like, and you guys will understand this, leaving somewhere with all of your stuff in a black trash bag, like looking at the ground, everybody just shakes their head, like there they go again. You know, we knew they wouldn't do it. Like I've done that so many times, that walk down the hallway at a program with every girl in the joint, like fuck her, we knew it. You know what I mean? I knew she was using. I've done it so many times. So I left LA with all my stuff in a trash bag and I came down here. And I actually kind of did quit doing Coke, mostly because I couldn't find anything down here that was like, that I liked. But I refused to quit drinking. I refused to quit drinking. Like I could buy that the Coke was a problem, but I was not going to quit drinking. I was 28 years old. Who's going to go on a date with me if I can't drink, right? That was my big thing. Like I can't date somebody. You meet for a drink. That's what you do. That's how you meet someone. I'm not doing this. I don't have a problem with drinking. So I didn't quit drinking. And I ended up strung out on heroin, like you do when you don't quit drinking. I ended up meeting somebody who was doing heroin, unbeknownst to me, and I ended up strung out on heroin because heroin kind of felt like Coke, but I could sleep, right? And I ended up strung out on heroin, and heroin bad is very, very different from Coke bad, which I'm sure some of you guys know. And within 10 months, I was homeless, and the next 5 years of my life were what I was talking about, right? Homeless, jail, in and out of programs, strung out, no ID, right? Hadn't worked in forever. And my consequences got increasingly worse over time, right? I ended up using needles and I got arrested more and more and more. My last arrest was for strong arm robbery and they were gonna give me a strike in California and send me to prison. And that was my last arrest, which was in 2013. And the consequences were just getting like worse and worse and worse. And I was in and out of programs. And what I would do is, this was my thing. I would live in your sober living. Where am I? Oh, 10 minutes. Oh, that was fast. Okay. I would live in your sober living. See, Carmina, I'm faster than I thought that I would be. She was like, this girl's going to need the timer. I would live in your sober living and I would use. And I would pass your drug test. Because I got really, really good at passing drug tests. I could pass a drug test. I could pass a pee test. I was always ready. And I would live in a sober living and I would pass a pee test. And I was strung out on meth and heroin. And I was living in a sober living here in Vista, actually. And they drug tested me that morning. It was New Year's Eve, 2014, going into 2015. And I passed a drug test. And I went out that night with a friend of mine who was sober. We'd actually used together and he'd got busted, gone to prison for a few years, got out. We were like hanging out. He knew I was using, but he was always like kind of trying to help me, you know? And We were out that night, and the sober living lady called me, the owner of the sober living called me. And she said, "So, Janine, you left some heroin on the counter here in the bathroom, and you can't come back." And I remember thinking, to her, of course, I was immediately like, I don't know if some of you guys relate to this. I feel like dope fiends, we could all be like part-time defense lawyers. I was like, "Hey man, that's circumstantial evidence. 8 other women live there and they're all in recovery. Like, you don't know that's my heroin." And she said, and I said, "I passed a piss test for you this morning." And she was like, "You're right, Janine. You did pass a pee test this morning, but all the other girls are here. We're all pretty sure it's yours. So, and I don't know how you've been passing your tests, but I tell you what, if you can bring me a blood test that says you're clean, I'll support you and you can come back." And nobody had ever asked me for that before. And to her, I was like, "Fine." You know, when I got up, I was like, "I'll do it tomorrow." And I remember getting off the phone and I said to my friend, I was like, "Okay, hey, give me your phone." Cause I had like a flip phone. I didn't even have a regular phone. I had like the phone they give you when you get out of jail at that time. I don't know if they still do it, the Obama phone. But I had my flip phone and I was like, "Give me your phone. I need to Google the Tri-City logo so that I can doctor a blood test. And I don't know what it looks like. I need the logo and I need to look up the drug test and see what it looks like. And do they sell Kinko's? Like, I'll just like do some meth and tweak out on this document. I've actually forged a medical document before. I can make this document, whatever." And by now he had actually gotten me a motel room for the night and we're sitting there. And like, he always kind of backed me up, you know, no matter what I was saying. And in this moment, as I was saying all this stuff, he was just like sitting there looking at me, like not backing me up. And I kind of stopped what I was saying and I was like, "Okay, come on, man. Don't look at me like that. I don't want to do this. She's making me forge this document. I don't want to forge a document. She's making me forge a document. I can't kick outside. I was going to kick. I have a Suboxone. I had a Suboxone that someone had taken a bite out of. So I had a half of a Suboxone in a cigarette cellophane and I was going to kick. And I was like always going to kick. And I don't know if there are any heroin addicts in here, but I was always going to kick, but I ended up just getting a Suboxone charge because it was always on me and I would get picked up. And I was like, no, I was going to kick. But of course I didn't have a prescription for the Suboxone. So anyways, I had a Suboxone on me and I was like, I was going to kick. I can't do it outside. She's making me forge this blood test. What am I supposed to do?" And he said, "I mean, you could get clean." And I, like, obviously people had said that to me before, right? This has been 15 years of bullshit from me. People had told me to get clean before. But for some reason in that moment coming from him, I thought like, fuck, man, I am working so hard to just destroy my life, you know? Like, I guess I could try that. Like, I could try to get sober, I guess. And I remember I sat down, but I wasn't ready that night because I still had some heroin. And the next morning, I didn't have anywhere to go because I'd been kicked out of my sober living. And I called a friend of mine, my heroin connect. And I said, "I don't know where I'm going to go. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't have anywhere to go." And he said, "Well, I have a place that you can stay. You can stay in the doghouse in my backyard." And I said, "Great, really?" And he was like, "Yeah, totally." And I was like, "Thank you, that works for me. Thank you, that's awesome." And my buddy brought me to an alley in Oceanside and I went in this little fence and I stayed in this guy's doghouse. It was actually kind of like half shed, half doghouse, to be fair. Like, you could like stand up kind of. And his dog would sleep in it. There was like a San Diego Chargers blanket on the floor. And he brought the dog inside and let me stay in the doghouse. And I stayed there for 3 nights in January. I stayed in this doghouse. And I remember like the second night, I was smoking meth, shooting heroin, and I had a compact with a light on it so I could pick my face in the dark, which was like something I was always doing. And I was doing a crossword puzzle because like, I got a 1400 on my SATs, you know what I mean? And I would like tell you that if we were like hanging out together, like I would be hanging out with other drug addicts and be like, "You know, I know that you obviously have a problem and you will probably end up in 12 step, but I did really well on my SATs 20 years ago. And it like kept me different, right? This idea that I had gotten into college, I didn't even finish, but I was like, I went to college sort of, you know? And I remember I'm smoking meth and I'm doing this crossword puzzle and I was like, this is happening. This is real. And he would actually padlock me in at night from the outside because he had let another girl stay there once before and his wife found out and she was like coming after her. It was crazy. She was chasing her with a chainsaw. That's a true story. And I remember sitting in the doghouse thinking, like, this is real. Like, I'm 34 years old. I'm living in a doghouse hoping I don't get murdered by a chainsaw tonight. Like, this is real, picking my face in the dark. And my life in recovery became like a series of miracles starting at around now. And I had my phone, and a friend of mine who is a Marine was back from Afghanistan, and he happened to call me. And actually, neither one of us remembers if I called him or he called me. He must have called me, because like I don't think I would have had the wherewithal to like, but he would come back from tours and check in and be like, are you alive? You know what I mean? Like, can I buy you food? Whatever. And he was back, and he was out at 29 Palms. And he called me, and I answered, and he said, hey, I'm back. What are you doing? And I said, I am living in a doghouse in Oceanside, and I think I'm going to die. And I think I'm going to die. And he said, okay, if I come get you tomorrow, like, will you be there? And I said, yes, I'll be there. And there was a Burger King right there. And so the next morning I went to the Burger King, and I actually called my mom, and she was on her way to church, and she stopped at the Burger King. And I always share this. She stopped at the Burger King, and I wanted $5 for cigarettes, and she wouldn't even give me $5. And I was like, and again, I was like, well, now he's going to have to buy me cigarettes. Thanks. Like, he has to buy me cigarettes. You know, like, you know, I'm like, now somebody else just has to take care of me. And she was like, well, I guess he's going to buy you cigarettes, you know. And she brought me vitamin C tablets and a Clif Bar and wouldn't give me any money. And I was like, I don't need this shit, you know. So she said, good luck, honey. You know, I hope this is the time that works for you. And she left me at the Burger King, and they made me go outside into the parking lot, because I was like, obviously a homeless person. And I had my one half-eaten Suboxone. My buddy came and got me and brought me out to 29 Palms. And I kicked heroin for the last time. I brought a little dope with me, of course. And then when that ran out, I had my one sub. And then I drank for like another 10 days. And January 15th, 2015, I was done. And I've never used nor drank again. And I wasn't in a program, and I wasn't in jail, and nothing about that should have worked. And I had tried so many times. I didn't really like heroin, like for real. I don't even really like heroin. But every single time I ended up getting strung out anyways. And so what was different this time, right? This is what I want to share. What was different? So while I was there, I had arranged, oh, this part's important too. So I hate the term chronic relapser, but I'm going to use it because you guys know will know what I mean. Somebody might have labeled you a chronic relapser at some point. I'm a chronic relapser, right? Like all the programs call me that. I can't go anywhere anymore. But here's what the bonus is about being a chronic relapser. While I was there, I set up a sober living to go to here, right? While I was there, I called somebody like the last place left, and he let me come back. I had a sponsor I was calling every single day. And I realized just a few years ago, I was telling somebody that story. And she was like, oh, so you already knew Rachel, my sponsor? And I said, oh yeah, she'd been my sponsor for a while. And she said, and you knew the guy with the sober living, Steve? And I said, oh yeah, because I'd lived there before. And I realized all of my in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out, I was actually gathering resources, and they were there and ready when I was ready to execute. And so all of those attempts, when we come in, we're learning more. Think about the first time you tried, right? Like, I had never even heard of Suboxone. I didn't know what it's going to be like to kick, right? Like, if you're someone that's in and out and in and out, you're already ahead of the game. You probably have a big book laying around, right? You probably have a just for today or a basic text. You could probably text somebody right now and be like, I'm back. Can you sponsor me? And they'll be like, sure. You know, like, now you know people. Like, you're ahead of the game. And I didn't realize that. I only felt like a failure. But I was learning more and more and more every single time that I came in. So I set up this sober living and I came back, and I immediately started doing, so I'm like a step person. I'm kind of a nerd about steps. I love step two. Step two changed my life. But I'd done step work before, and I called a sponsor. I had done those things, and it wasn't working anyways, right? And so what I always try to do is I try to share something different, because it was three really key mindsets that changed the game for me, because I had done those other things. And I know that everybody you've listened to has said, get a sponsor, do steps, go to meetings, and all of that stuff is true. And by the way, the reason that that stuff is true is that in addition to what you learn on that journey, when you start building a case for yourself that you're someone in recovery, your brain starts to recognize and build a case that you're someone in recovery. Neurologically speaking, I'm going to nerd out for just one second. There's something in your brain called the RAS, the reticular activation system. And it's why you can hear your name in like a loud room. Your brain starts to look for things, and you tell it what's important. My name's important, right? I'm a chronic relapser. We're going to build a case to say that I'm a failure. Or I'm going to take 30 days. I'm going to stand up. I'm going to say my name. I'm going to take 60 days. I'm going to finish this step. I'm going to call my sponsor. My brain starts building a case that I'm a person in recovery. And that's in a very real way why those concrete things that you hear about all of the time are so necessary for this. But what else? Like, what was different this time? This is what was different for me. I'd just come back to the sober living. And this sober living manager and I had been through the rounds, this dude Steve, because I'd lived there and sold dope on the property twice. He'd had to kick me out. It was like a whole thing. And he was letting me come back and stay on the couch because I didn't have any money. And the odds of me staying sober were like super low. He knew that and I know that. And I was getting sober in the area that I used, right? And I was at the McDonald's right by the sober living. And I saw this dude that I used with. And he was like, hey, like, where you been? Get your ass in here. I got a shot for you. In the bathroom at the McDonald's. And I was still kind of sick, right? Like, I didn't have that much time. And I didn't want to be rude. And I was like, I'll be right back, you know? And like, you know, in the beginning, I'm not going to be like, well, I'm clean now. And I was like, I'll be right back, hold on. But I was really scared and I didn't want to do it. And I left and I ran up the hill to my sober living and my manager was standing outside and I was like, dude, do I tell him? You know what, yeah, I'm trying to do things different. I'm just going to tell him. So I ran up to him and I was like, Steve, you know, I just saw so-and-so and he offered me a shot of heroin and like, dude, it's free heroin. Like, I should go back. It's free heroin. You know, who gives up free heroin? And I remember he was like, that shit isn't free. What do you mean free? That's the worst return on investment I've ever seen a human being make. Like, that heroin isn't free. What are you talking about? Fucking free. Like, how are we having this conversation? What has it done to your life? And I was like, okay, yeah, you're right. It's not free. Fine. Okay. So I went into my little apartment thing and he came up a few minutes later. And he was like, I'm not done with you. And I remember being like, of course you're not done with me. What? And he started like giving me a hard time again. And he had been a crack addict. He had like 10 years clean. And I stopped him and I was like, hey, listen, you're being really hard on me, dude. I was like, if somebody offered you crack, you would like think about it for a second. You would. And before I could even finish, he kind of cut me off. And he was like, no, that would never happen to me. That would never happen to me because I've taken a stand in this community and people know who I am. He was like, you have lived a criminal and addict lifestyle for so long, you cannot ride the line where you're talking to these guys. You've got one foot in the dope world, one foot in sobriety. You have been on that line for way too long. He's like, you're like the little kid that sleeps on the edge of the bed and keeps falling out of the bed thinking, why do I keep falling out of the bed? You need to be all the way up against the wall when you sleep. You need to pick a fucking side. And I like heard that. And what that looked like for me, somebody said this when he took his 60 days, what that looked like for me was I finally deleted the contacts in my phone, which I didn't want to do because some of those people were my friends. And in program, I know they'll tell you, they're not your friends. They want you to die. Like whatever your counselor is saying. Some of those dudes were my friends. But the reality is that their life no longer aligns with my goals, right? Their life choices no longer align with my goals. They're still my friends. But that doesn't mean I need their number in my phone anymore, right? And that was the first time that I had ever done that. I also picked up a commitment at a meeting, which I had never done. I picked up a secretary commitment at that same sober living, so I didn't have a car, obviously. And I could be the secretary at that meeting. And that's another thing that when I started to do that, and like I didn't lose the notebook, you know? And I actually kept going, and I started sharing and building a little confidence. And I picked a side. Because I was also always the person in program that you could come to me if you relapsed and I'd be like, oh shit, what are you gonna do? Like, I can help you pee clean. And I was like, I need to be the person that it's like, don't tell Janine, she'll tell on you. Like, I need to be the recovery chick that like you don't wanna tell if you used. I need to pick a side. Next thing that happened was I was turning 35 and I had 90 days and I was turning 35. And when I came back, I didn't even have an ID. Like my mom was like, oh, well, maybe I can go with you to Social Security and I'll swear an affidavit that I gave birth to you in Orlando, Florida, and I've got my ID. And like, there was no way to prove I was even a person, you know, like I wasn't even a person. No ID and check systems, like no bank account, any of that. And I was still going to a check cash place. I'd gotten a job and I was going to a check cash place and I was turning 35. And I'd gone to that school and I got good SAT scores. And I was 35 and I was basically a homeless person, right? Living on a couch. And you know how it is. Like everybody around me was like, yeah, but you're clean, man. That's what matters, man. You know, like you're sober. And I remember thinking, yeah, that's not really doing it for me this time. You know what I mean? Like, because if you could go back, if like the ghost of Christmas future could go back to my high school in 1998 and stop me walking down the hallway and be like, Janine, do you want to see where you're going to be when you're 35? I've been like, totally. I'm sure I'm going to be famous and rich and married for sure and a homeowner. Like, show me. And if the ghost of Christmas future has been like, yeah, none of that shit's going to happen. But what you will have going for you is you will be 90 days off of heroin. And for you, that will be a great achievement at that point in your life. I'd be like, what the fuck? That can't be right. Like, this is the AP side of the high school. You're supposed to be on the other side of the high school. Like, that cannot be right. I would have been devastated. You know, this is not my life. And I went outside and I was doing this like meditation series because I was doing the programmy stuff, right? And I was doing meditation, and there was a meditation that was centered around gratitude. And the quote was, gratitude unlocks the fullness of life and makes what we have enough and more. Gratitude unlocks the fullness of life and makes what we have enough and more. And I was listening to that, and I was outside, and we had like couches that had been like rained on, and I was smoking other people's butts from the ashtrays. Didn't have any cigarettes. So I'm out there smoking, like, I remember it was a menthol too. And I was like, oh, fuck, it's not even good. So I'm like smoking the butt of somebody else's cigarette. And I did this meditation, and I was listening and breathing and doing all this stuff. And I remember I took the headphones off and I sat there for a second, and I was overcome with the feeling of not being dope sick and not being hungover and not needing to get well, right? And I remember mornings after doing coke and drinking all night, long before I was doing heroin, being like on the ground in the bathroom in like the most physical pain I thought that a human being could like have. And in that moment, I was so overcome with gratitude to be not in pain in my body, nor needing anything, right? I didn't need to go get $20 so that I could breathe. Like, to tears, gratitude. And then I realized that there was a really nice like view in front of me. And I thought, well, that's a nice view. And then I realized, well, that didn't just get there. That's always been there. I just couldn't see it. And then I thought, well, the reason I can see it is because I'm so grateful to not be sick right now from using. Did my addiction give me this gratitude that I'm feeling right now? Did my addiction leave me better off? Because if I'm really honest, that kid in high school who was headed to a great college wasn't that happy and couldn't see anything in front of me, right? And definitely not me in LA. All I was obsessed with what had gone wrong in the past and the future that I thought that I had lost. I didn't appreciate anything. And in that moment, I was forced to see something really beautiful that had always been in front of my eyes that I couldn't see. And what I was experiencing was something called post-traumatic growth. And most people have heard of post-traumatic stress, right? And when men and women like go off to fight overseas, they tell them you've got two ways to come back. Status quo, the same, or fucked up. We want you status quo. That's the goal. But there's a third way back from trauma, and that's post-traumatic growth. And what happens is after a traumatic experience, like the ones that we have all survived in this room, typically you feel physically resilient. You feel physically stronger. You develop some sort of spirituality that maybe we wouldn't have had. Our relationships with people around us are empowered and stronger, and our lives are actually better because of what we survived. That's what I was feeling that night. That's what I was feeling. We have the opportunity not just to bounce back, but to bounce forward. And that grind in the beginning, that newcomer grind that we've all gone through, no car, no one believes you, no nice phone. I remember being at Tri-City and people would have iPhones. And I was like, you could have gotten another bag, dude. Like, how do you have that iPhone? I would have clunked that shit. Like, what? How do you have an iPhone in here you could use again? You know, like just nothing, just nothing. And I had done one thing before I left, before I went to the doghouse, actually. Gotten on Craigslist. And I had, because also amidst all of my using, I taught spin and like Pilates and stuff. So I smoked meth and teach spin and shoot heroin and teach spin for years. And I somehow actually managed to do that. And when I got back, I auditioned for this studio in Encinitas. I got the gig and I taught my first class with 19 days clean. And taking the bus there, that whole grind, you guys know the deal, right? I met my husband at a 12-step meeting also. My cute husband who's 7 years younger than me. And that was my big thing too as a woman. I was like, who the fuck's gonna go out with me? I shot heroin. I lived in a doghouse, you know? Like, nobody's ever gonna go out with me. Wrong. Somebody in here will go out with you, probably. Met my husband, we got married. And at the 4-year mark, I actually bought that studio that I started at, and we owned it. And I always suspected that that newcomer grind that I'm talking about gave us an edge in life. And it was proven to me during the pandemic because it was a gym, right? And during COVID, it was completely shut down. And all the gyms around us, everybody was freaking out and closing down. Not us, because we know how to grind when it's difficult. And we built an outdoor area, and I never missed one day. We went online that week. Now, it wasn't pretty or graceful. I was freaking the fuck out the whole time. But there wasn't one day when I didn't put one foot in front of the other, because I know how to do that, because I've lost everything and rebuilt, and you probably know how to do that too. And we doubled the valuation of that studio during the pandemic and flipped it for double what we paid on the precipice of the recession that we're in right now. And I don't say that because I'm like, you know, bragging about what we did. I say that because we have that power as addicts in recovery, that dope fiend hustle that can become the newcomer grind that becomes the life that you build on now, right? Like, it's not something I'm ashamed of. My addiction and my past and the crime and all that stuff, it is not a liability. It is my greatest asset. You know, I believe that. And it's important to me that other people believe that too and see that too. And that when I heard at that first CA meeting a long, long time ago, we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. I don't anymore at all. And I am so open about my life and my experience. And I am so proud to be an addict. It's the best thing about me. I am so proud to be a drug addict. I'm proud to be in this room with you guys. I'm proud to be clean. Thank you guys so much.